You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. Tonight we're gathered to hear about The Terranauts, Tom's new novel, which he'll discuss, which has been called a not-quite-historical novel, drawing for inspiration on the real-life eco-experiment called Biosphere 2 in Oracle, Arizona, in the mid-90s. And that is not too far from my memory. I had an acquaintance with one of those original Biospherians, strange man. His characters are consensually confined under a large dome, which is constantly monitored, and the writing, which probes their mutual survival, entertainment, and mental health, as well as Boyle's real-life environmental concerns, is often hilariously funny. The Terranauts is T. Correggison Boyle's 26th book of fiction. You're familiar, I'm sure, with many of them, The Inner Circle, The Tortilla Curtain, San Miguel, The Harder They Come, among others. He's a distinguished professor of English in the English department at USC, and his work has been translated into 24 foreign languages. He's published 15 novels and 10 volumes of short stories, including the Penn Faulkner Award-winning World's End, and he was also awarded the France's prestigious Prix Medici Etranger, and most recently the New York Times was on the bestseller list for The Harder They Come. With his astute observations on contemporary life in America and his startling ability to bring history alive, it's no wonder he's been called one of our most American novelists since Mark Twain and one of our best. We're also happy to welcome back to the Aloud stage Michael Silverblatt, host of KCRW's half-hour radio show, Bookworm. KCRW is our media partner, and we thank them. Not the least claim to his fame, but Michael has interviewed many authors for us on the stage at Aloud over the years, and he's been a great friend to the Los Angeles Public Library, and he's also known as one of America's great readers. So please join me in welcoming T.C. Boyle and Michael Silverblatt back to the stage.
Hello, thanks for that wonderful, wonderful welcome. A couple of nights ago, I was in the New York Public Library doing a similar thing. The crowd wasn't nearly as good-looking as you, by the way. But beforehand, the curator took us into the special books room and laid out a display of things he thought that would appeal to me. And what fascinated me was there were three little copies of books that Dickens would use on stage, the actual books that he wrote in to prompt himself on stage, and with things crossed out and little notes in the margin like, be dramatic here, you know? It was just absolutely great. I don't quite make so many comments to myself, but I wish that we had the technology in those days to have see what he looked like on stage. I hear he was a magnificent performer. He also, by the way, cut out any difficult passages, frightening things, murders, and so on, so the audience would be perfectly happy and not worry too much. I don't really take that approach. So tonight we will talk about the book, which is a part of my, I guess, obsession with ecology. My books keep coming back to the same themes, A Friend of the Earth, for instance, from 2000 about global warming, or When the Killing's Done about the ethics of removing invasive creatures, killing the invasive creatures. And now, as Louise has said so beautifully, this is a book that takes the biosphere experiment and then fictionalizes a second closure just to see what it might mean. But because I don't often do what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to read you the first two sections of the brand new story, which just comes out in the New Yorker this week. It's my newest obsession, which is with CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology, which in essence allows us quite quickly and easily to transplant genes from one species into another. The story is called, Are We Not Men? The dog was the color of a maraschino cherry, and what it had in its jaws I couldn't make out at first, not until it parked itself under the hydrangeas and began throttling the thing. This little episode would have played out without my even noticing, except that I'd gone to the stove to put on a kettle for a cup of tea and happened to glance out the window at the front lawn. The lawn, a deep, lush blue-green that managed to hint at both the turquoise of the sea and the viridian of a Kentucky meadow, was something I took special pride in. And any wandering dog, no matter its chromatics, was an irritation to me. The seed had been pricey. A blend of chewings, fescue, bahia, and zoysia incorporating a gene from a species of algae that allowed it to glow under the porch light at night. And while it was both disease and drought resistant, it didn't take well to foot traffic, especially four-footed traffic. I stepped out on the porch and clapped my hands, thinking to shoo the dog away. But it didn't move. Well, actually it did, but only to flex its shoulders and tighten its jaws around its prey, which I now saw was my neighbor Allison's pet micro pig. The pig itself, doe-eyed and no bigger than a Pekingese, didn't seem to be struggling, or not any longer. And even as I came down off the porch looking to grab the first thing I could find to brandish at the dog, I felt my heart thundering. Allison was one of those pet owners who tend to anthropomorphize their animals, and that pig was the center of her unmarried and unboyfriended life. She would be shattered, absolutely. And who was going to break the news to her? I felt a surge of anger. How had the stupid thing got out of the house anyway? And for that matter, whose dog was this? I didn't own a garden rake, and there were no sticks on the lawn. The trees were an edited variety that didn't drop anything, not twigs, seeds, or leaves, no matter the season. So I stormed across the grass, empty-handed, shouting the first thing that came to mind, which was, bad, bad dog. I wasn't thinking. And the effect wasn't what I would have hoped for, even if I had been. The dog dropped the pig all right, which was clearly beyond revivification at this point. But in the same motion, it lurched up and clamped its jaws on my left forearm, growling continuously as if my forearm were a stick it had fetched in a friendly game between us. Curiously, there was no pain and no blood either. Just a firm, insistent pressure, the saliva hot and wet on my skin as I pulled in one direction, and the dog, all the while regarding me out of a pair of dull, uniform eyes, pulled in the other. Let go, I demanded. But the dog didn't let go. Bad dog, I repeated. I tugged. The dog tugged back. There was no one on the street, no one in the next yard over, no one in the house behind me to come to my aid. I was dressed in the t-shirt, shorts, and slippers I'd pulled on not 10 minutes earlier when I'd got out of bed. And here I was, caught up in this maddening interspecies pas de deux at 8 in the morning of an otherwise ordinary day, already exhausted. The dog, this cherry-red hairless freak with the armored skull and bulging musculature of a pit bull, showed no sign of giving in. It had got my arm, and it meant to keep it. After a minute of this, I went down on one knee to ease the tension in my back, a gesture that only seemed to excite the animal all the more, its nails tearing up divots as it fought for purchase, trying, it occurred to me now, to bring me down to its level. Before I knew what I was doing, I balled up my free hand and punched the thing in the head 3 times in quick succession. The effect was instantaneous. The dog dropped my arm and let out a yelp, backing off to hover at the edge of the lawn and eye me warily, as if now, all at once, the rules of the game had changed. In the next moment, just as I realized I was, in fact, bleeding, a voice cried out behind me. Hey, I saw that! A girl was striding across the lawn toward me. A preternaturally tall girl I at first took to be a teenager, but was actually a child of 11 or 12. As soon as she appeared, the dog fell in step with her, and everything became clear. She marched directly up to me, glaring, and said, You hit my dog! I was in no mood. I'm bleeding, I said, holding out my arm in evidence. You see this? Your dog bit me. You ought to keep him chained up. That's not true. Ruby would never bite anybody. She was just playing is all. I wasn't about to debate her. This was my property, my arm. And that lump of flesh lying there bleeding into the grass was Allison's dead pet. I pointed to it. Oh, she said, her voice dropping. I'm so sorry. Is it yours? It's my neighbor's. I gestured to the house just visible over the hedge. She's going to be devastated. This pig, I wanted to call it by name, personalize it, but couldn't for the life of me remember its name, is all she has. And it wasn't cheap, either. I glanced at the dog, its pinkish gaze and incarnadine flanks, as I'm sure you can appreciate. The girl, who stood 3 or 4 inches taller than me, and whose own eyes were an almost iridescent shade of violet that didn't exist in nature, or at least hadn't until recently, gave me an unflinching look. Maybe she doesn't have to know. What do you mean she doesn't have to know? The thing's dead. Look at it. Maybe it was run over by a car. You want me to lie to her? The girl shrugged. The dog, panting, settled down on its haunches. I already said I'm sorry. Ruby got out the front gate when my mother went to work, and I came right after her. You saw me. What about this? I demanded, holding up my arm, which wasn't so much punctured as abraded, since most of the new breeds had their canines and carnassials genetically modified to prevent any real damage in a situation like this. It has its shots, right? She's a cherry pit, the girl said, giving me a look of disgust. Germline immunity comes with a package. I mean, everybody knows that. It was a Tuesday, and I was working from home as I did every Tuesday and Thursday. I worked in IT like practically everybody else on the planet, and I found I actually got more done at home than when I went into the office. My coworkers were a trial, what with their moods, opinions, facial tics, and all the rest. Not that I didn't like them. It was just that they always seemed to manage to get in the way at crunch time. Or maybe I didn't like them. Maybe that was it. At any rate, after the little contretemps with the girl and her dog, I went back in the house, smeared an antibiotic ointment on my forearm, took my tea and a handful of protein wafers to my desk, and sat down at the computer. If I gave the dead pig a thought, it was only in relation to Allison. Who'd want to see the corpse, I supposed, which brought up the question of what to do with it. Let it lie where it was, or stuff it in a trash bag and refrigerate it till she got home from the office. I thought of calling my wife. Connie was regional manager of Bank USA, by necessity a master of interpersonal relations, and she would know what to do. But then it was hardly worth bothering her at work over something so trivial. I could have buried the corpse, I suppose, or tossed it in the trash and played dumb. But in the end, I wound up doing nothing. It was past 3 by the time I thought to take a lunch break, and because it was such a fine day, I brought my sandwich and a glass of iced tea out into the front porch. By this juncture, I'd forgotten all about the pig, the dog, and the grief that was brewing for Allison. But as soon as I stepped out the door, it all came back to me. The trees were alive with crow parrots, variously screeching, cawing, and chattering amongst themselves, and they were there for a very specific reason. I don't know if you have crow parrots in your neighborhood yet, but believe me, they're coming. They were the inspiration of one of the molecular embryologists at the university here who felt that inserting genes of the common crow into the invasive parrot population would put an end to the parrot's raids on our orchards and vineyards, giving them a taste for garbage and carrion instead of fruit on the vine, and having the added benefit of displacing the native crows, which had pretty well eliminated songbirds from our backyards. The only problem was the noise factor. Something in the mix seemed to have redoubled not only the volume but the fury of the birds' calls, so that half the time you needed earplugs if you wanted to enjoy pretty much any outdoor activity, which was the case now. The birds were everywhere, cursing fluidly, "Bad bird, fuck, fuck, fuck," and flapping their spangled wings in one another's faces. Alarmed, I came down off the porch and for the second time that day scrambled across the lawn to the flower bed where a scrum of birds had settled on the remains of Allison's pet. I flailed my arms, and they lifted off reluctantly into the sky, screeching, "Turd bird!" and the fractured call that awakened me practically every morning, "Cock sucker!" As for the pig, which I should have dragged into the garage, I realize that now, its eyes were gone, and its faintly bluish hide was striped with bright red gashes. Truthfully, I didn't want to touch the thing. The birds were filthy. Who knew what zoonoses they were carrying? So I was just standing there, in a quandary, when Allison's car pulled into the driveway next door, scattering light. Allison was in her early 30s, with a top-heavy figure and a barely tamed kink of ginger hair she kept wrapped up in various scarves, which gave her an exotic look, as if she were displaced here in the suburbs. She was sad-faced and sweet, the victim of one catastrophic relationship after another, and I couldn't help feeling protective toward her, a single woman, alone in that big house her mother had left her when she died. So when she came across the lawn, already tearing up, I felt I'd somehow let her down. And before I could think, I'd stripped off my shirt and draped it over the corpse. Is that her? She asked, looking down at the hastily covered bundle at my feet. No, she said, don't tell me. And then her eyes jumped to mine, and she was repeating my name, Roy, 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 as if ringing it in her throat. Fuck you, the crow parrots cried from the trees. Fuck, fuck, fuck. In the next moment, she flung herself into my arms, clutching me to her so desperately I could barely breathe. I don't want to see, she said in a small voice, each syllable a hot puff of breath on the bare skin of my chest. I could smell her hair, her shampoo she used, the taint of sweat under her arms. The poor thing, she murmured, and lifted her face so I could see the tears blurring her eyes. I loved her, Roy. I really loved her. This called up a scene from the past, a dinner party at Allison's, Connie and me, another couple, and Allison and her last inamorata, a big-headed boar who worked for animal control, incinerating strays and transgenic misfits. Allison had kept the pig in her lap throughout the meal, feeding it from her plate, and afterward, while we sat around the living room cradling brandies and Benedictine, she propped the thing up at the piano where it picked out Twinkle Twinkle Little Star with its modified hooves. No, I said, agreeing with her. You don't want to look. It was a dog, right? That's what... And here she had to break off a moment to gather herself. That's what Terry Wolfson said when she called me at work. I was going to offer up some platitude about how the animal hadn't suffered, though for all I knew, the dog had gummed it relentlessly the way it had gummed my arm, when a voice called, Hello! From the street behind us, and we broke hastily apart. Coming up the walk was the tall girl, tottering on a pair of platform heels, and she had the dog with her, this time on a leash. I felt a stab of annoyance. Hadn't she caused enough trouble already? And embarrassment, that too. It wasn't like me to go shirtless in public or to be caught in a full-body embrace with my unmarried next-door neighbor either, for that matter. If she could read my face, the girl gave no indication of it. She came right up to us, the dog trotting along docilely at her side. Her violet gaze swept from me to the lump on the ground beneath the bloodied T-shirt, and finally to Allison. Je suis désolée, madame, she said. Pardonnez-moi, mon chien ne savait pas ce qu'il faisait. Il est un bon chien, vraiment. This girl, this child, loomed over us, her features animated. She was wearing eyeliner, lipstick, and blush, as if she were 10 years older and on her way to a nightclub. And her hair, blonde with a natural curl, spread like a tent over her shoulders and dangled all the way down to the small of her back. What are you saying, I demanded, and why are you speaking French? Because I can. Puedo hablar en español también, und ich kann auch in Deutsch sprechen. My IQ is 162, and I can run the 100 meters in 9.58 seconds. Wonderful, I said, exchanging a look with Allison. Terrific, really. But what are you doing here? What do you want? Your mother, the birds cried. Up yours! The girl shifted from one foot to the other, looking awkward like the child she was. I just wanted to please, please beg you not to report Ruby to animal control, because my father says they'll come and put her down. She's a good dog, she really is, and she never did anything like this before, and we never, never, ever let her run loose. It was just a freak occurrence, I said. Right, she said, an anomaly, an accident. Allison's jaw tightened. The dog looked tranquilly up at us out of its pink eyes as if all this was none of its concern. A bugless breeze rattled the trees across the street. And what am I supposed to say, Allison put in. How am I supposed to feel? What do you want, forgiveness? Well, I'm sorry, but I just can't do it. Not now. She gave the girl a fierce look. You love your dog? The girl nodded. Well, I loved Shoshana, too. She choked up. More than anything in the world. We all took a minute to gaze down on the carcass. Then the girl lifted her eyes. My father says we'll pay all damages. Here, she said, digging into her purse and producing a pair of business cards, one of which she handed to me and the other to Allison. Any medical treatment you may need, we'll take care of 100%, she assured me, eyeing my arm doubtfully before turning to Allison. And replace your pet, too, if you want, madame. It was a micropig, right, from Recombicorp? It was a painful moment. I could feel for Allison and the girl, too, though Connie and I didn't have any pets, not even one of the new hypoallergenic breeds. And we didn't have children either, though we discussed it often enough. There was a larger sadness at play here, the sadness of attachment and loss and the way the world wreaks its changes, whether we're ready for them or not. We would have gotten through the moment, I think, coming to some sort of understanding. Allison wasn't vindictive, and I wasn't about to raise a fuss. But that same breeze swept across the lawn to flip back the edge of the T-shirt and expose the eyeless head of the pig, and that was all it took. Allison let out a gasp, and the dog, that crimson freak, jerked the leash out of the girl's hand and went right for it. Well, thank you so much. I just felt like giving you a little extracurricular treat. I'd love to read you the entire story, but you can read it in this week's New Yorker. And I am eager to talk with my dear friend, Michael Silverblatt. Hello, my dear fellow.
I'm curious. Once upon a time, they wouldn't allow birds to talk like that in New York.
Times have changed, Michael. Witness the fact that they publish me.
Yeah, that also. Isn't that interesting? So literature really has changed, and in part, it's the cause of the themes that you bring to it, yes?
Perhaps, but there's also another factor, and I don't want to shock anyone in the audience, but as far as we know, everyone who's ever lived has died. And editors tend to die. The ones who hate you and don't want you in the magazine. And new editors are born, the benevolent artistic souls who realize true beauty when they see it.
Talking about true beauty, I read The Terranauts and found it to be really one of your most wonderfully shaped books.
Thank you.
And I'm wondering about, you know, you say that your themes have more or less progressed along a certain line, but I think each of your books is in a different shape.
I hope so. You know, I think for my money, an artist is someone who pushes him or herself every time out and tries to discover new things. And as far as the themes are concerned, I can only see that looking back. So my first book is Descent of Man. It's a bunch of stories sort of like the one I just read part of to you. And I was obsessed. I've been always obsessed with biology. In fact, I probably could have been relatively happy as a field biologist. And who knows, if it weren't for the horror of math, physics, and chemistry, I might have been. And yes, you talk about structure of this one. As many of you will know, because I recognize you all, we've all done this before. I work intuitively. So for a book like this, I will study the actual history of Biosphere 2. All the details of that I can incorporate into this. It makes it real. And then I posit a second closure and invent characters. So I went to the Biosphere. I recommend everybody go there. The building is beautiful. It's northeast of Tucson. I read the accounts of the original Biospherians, and then voices begin to talk to me. I see pictures and voices talk to me. However, I always like to have a structure, a superstructure to hang things on, and it's as simple as this. I need a title, The Terranauts, which, of course, you know, apes sort of the astronauts or the aquanauts. I had an idea of structure. So there's pre-entry, when they're all fighting, the 16 candidates to be the 8 chosen to be locked inside for 2 years. Then there's year 1 of closure, year 2 of closure, and then re-entry. And I also love to have epigraphs. Somehow epigraphs state a proposition, and the book begins to wonder if it's true and to dramatize it. Let me give them those epigraphs, Michael. The epigraphs that begin The Terranauts are 2, and they kind of stand in opposition. The first is from Margaret Mead. Never doubt that a small group of committed, thoughtful people can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. The second is from Jean-Paul Sartre's No Exit. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Hell is other people. So So imagine yourself enclosed with seven other people, four men and four women, for 2 years with a seal that is not to be broken under any circumstances to see if we could create another biosphere like the one we live in the event that it should collapse or we might need to go elsewhere to some other planet to survive. What would that be like? And voila, here it goes.
Well, as I read, I realized that the book was getting, to my great pleasure, more and more interesting. And I might be wrong here, and I have a great deal of respect for my colleagues, but I felt that the people who reviewed the book hadn't read all of it.
But you're telling me the reviews were terrible?
No, I'm saying...
Actually, I haven't read any of the reviews.
No, the reviews weren't terrible, but they didn't seem to notice that the book, as it passes its two-thirds point, presents one surprise after another, after another, after another, that couldn't have been expected by a reader reading just the first third. And I've been getting used to it. It used to shock me because I thought, well, people who get to review books are so lucky. They get them for free. Surely they always read them and read them two or three times, right? I mean, because we don't really understand a book till the second time we read it. And then the third time we see how carefully it's been constructed. Well, this book is a really careful book, and I want to begin by telling you, don't think that you know what kind of book this is until you finish it the first time. Has anyone here completed it yet? Clap if you have. Well, then you're in for a very good time, because those of you who think that the book is based upon an event that happened in approximately 1995, aren't reckoning the fact that T.C. Boyle brings full invention to that initial procedure. And by the time you're finished, you've been really taken past either the idea that reasonable people can change the world, or that hell is other people. There's a whole nother level. And life is the intersection between man and nature, but part of that intersection is the intersection between man and man, or man and woman.
And man and nature. And I couldn't agree more with your assessment, Michael. I was enchanted by it. I loved it. I thought it was absolutely great. And many of you have not had an opportunity yet because they did a strict laydown on sales until, I believe, Tuesday of last week. So it wasn't available even online or anywhere else. They do this to calculate for the bestseller list, just as the movie industry, you know, tries to open and so on. As for my part in marketing, I am very dutiful. I just go where they tell me. And sometimes I wind up on stage with you, and sometimes I wind up in a closet with some guy who is eating his own tie. And I just try to make the best of it.
And what is the best of it?
The best of it is to have an audience like this, to turn them on. I'm forever excited about what I'm doing as an artist and about the topics that come up, like this CRISPR gene editing technology. If any of you subscribe to Science or Nature, you may have noticed in the last year and a half, ads, huge ads, even sometimes inserted under the cover of the magazine, and it shows a fist in a boxing glove punching, and it says, "Knock out any gene." They are now selling you, for a mere $5,000, gene editing kits so that you can play and have fun with transposing genes from one species to another in your kitchen and make bacteria and yeast that never existed before. Now, is this a good idea? So I had to write that particular story in order to find out.
You started with The Descent of Man and Water Music as a wild man. Have you become tamer?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I have devoted myself to my work. And in order to do the work, we all would like to think that the writer, the musician, whoever it is a great genius and just snaps off the work and burns a candle at both ends and does what celebrities are supposed to do. It may be true, but in my case, it's not. I have to have the most regular life possible in order to produce my work, to go to bed around the same time. It's a routine. Everything has to be a routine. Incidentally, I have a doctor who is older than I am, which is quite remarkable in itself. And he's very funny. So during a physical we had a year or two ago, he examined everything, and then he asked questions. And one of the questions was, how do you sleep at night? And I said, Jerry, I sleep beautifully because I have a clean conscience. Without missing a beat, he said, yeah, either that or you have no scruples. And I think it is the latter, Michael.
These people who... See, as the book goes along, it becomes clear that these characters, who at first may seem to be, well, you know, there's a debate going on as to who's an asshole and who's a bitch, but you've lavished affection on all of them, asshole or bitch. Mm. And the interesting thing is that by the end of the book, the reader is suspended. You can't tell what Tom Boyle thinks of them.
That's marvelous. I hope that's true for all the readers because it makes it a richer experience. We should point out that, you know, I'm always experimenting with things I may not have done before to see how they work. So, for instance, in The Harder They Come, there are three characters, central characters, and you get their point of view in third person as orchestrated by me, the writer, standing over it. In this, for the first time ever, I've tried to see what would happen if there were three first-person narrators. So you get Dawn Chapman, who is 29, and she is a very attractive woman because this counts when people are looking through the glass and the TV cameras are on. We get Ramsay Ruthorpe, who is the communications officer and a little bit of a Lothario. And we get Linda Ryu, who has been excluded from the first 16. They're, as with the astronauts, they train together, they desperately want this, they are a cult, but they are going to take 8. She's excluded, but she will be promised a spot on the third closure if she stays on. So this enables me to alternate from eye narrators to speak directly to you and speak from their heart and about all of their insecurities, their prejudices against each other. And it seems to have worked in that way that each character then builds almost separately from one another into a major character. Who is the protagonist of the book? You can't answer that question. There are three, equally.
It's rather amazing. You would not have anticipated, and I'm not going to give away anything, I promise, that there would be a marriage in this book, that within the confines of such an incredibly restricted community, that there would also be a birth, and that all of these things contribute, of course, to the selling of the project. It's marvelous PR. So is it any wonder that the PR man is himself the husband? He knows how to butter his own bread. And it's a very interesting thing that love and personal dexterity are at sword's length from one another in this novel.
Absolutely. You know, this is such a wonderful project for me. It is given to me. The real history of the biosphere is incorporated. This was the first closure. Now we're going to have a second one. The project of the biosphere from 91 to 93 entailed finding a nice, cooperative, happy billionaire. And he, in cooperation with a creator, decided with tremendous chutzpah to create a new world, a new biosphere, different from anything else that we have ever seen on this earth. And it was so whimsical in a way. They created five biomes within 3.15 acres, 3,800 species of plants and animals. This closure of the actual history, Biosphere 2, was meant to be the first two-year closure of 50 successive closures. Unfortunately, as we all know from recent events, you can't trust your billionaires. They can be very erratic. And so 6 months into the second closure, the billionaire and the creator had a fight. The billionaire pulled the money out. Boom, gone. So ever after, the biosphere, which is a magnificent building, has never been closed as an experiment. Yes, the University of Arizona now owns it, and they conduct soil experiments and so on inside, but it's not the fascination that the public and I had when this happened. What would it be like? Absolute material closure, as if you are on Mars.
Like our Huntington Gardens, which contains, what, a Japanese garden, a bamboo garden, a desert garden, a cactus garden, different, what is the word?
Biome, different biomes.
Different biomes. Okay, in gathering these spaces, bringing in a marsh, an Olympic pool-sized ocean, a desert, you bring along termites, cockroaches, leeches, snakes,
mosquitoes.
All of them not a part of the official population. And so just like these volunteers who've made their way in, the human aggravations have been brought along without any preparations. They think they've brought people who are capable of working with one another.
And they've selected them for that very purpose, and they have a common goal.
And instead, what's thrilling to any novelist is that people are people, and given the chance, they will find a way to hate one another.
Well said. You know, imagine what Eugene O'Neill would have done with this. So yes, as Michael was saying, it's so rich because I have the actual history of what happened. So the facts are there for me to play with and then see what do they mean. So what Michael's referring to is they brought in these biomes and these creatures. They brought in three species of cockroaches because they are detritophores and they can be part of an ecosystem. However, while they were building this for a year, invasive creatures, volunteers, came in, including the cockroach that some of you unfortunates have under your sink right now in the dark while you're not home. And that cockroach took over. There were a couple of birds that were enclosed. As when you go to the airport, there's a bird flying around, you know. The world can't be made perfect. Eden is never going to be perfect.
There's a certain level at which, as I read the book, I found myself feeling as hungry as the characters are because there isn't enough food, you see, in this environment, nor is there any space. Nothing in, nothing out is their mantra. And so no additional food. When it gets hot and or very cold, the oxygen levels drop and the CO2 levels go up and the people are staggering around with headaches. And this is not any great pleasure for any of them. And so they're all in bad moods to begin with.
Well, okay, it's a great weight loss regime. The men lost 18% of their body weight, the women 10%. 1,500 calories a day, starvation diet, was the best they could muster. They had dwarf goats, they had dwarf pigs, they had some eggs from chickens, they had the milk from the goats, and of course, primarily a vegetarian diet. But you're feeding 8 people for 2 years. Things ran a little bit spare, you know. The pigs finally had to be slaughtered and eaten because they couldn't feed them anymore. So all of this does build tension. You're starving. You're working harder. You're a subsistence farmer, essentially, than you're bringing in calories. Now, again, I have the actual history to underlie all this. In the actual history, back in the in 91, when they had closure, these people were very, very well known, second only to astronauts. This was huge. They were on every news hour and front of every periodical, etc. This is a big deal. And the public's investment in it, my investment in it anyway, was that they were going to have absolute material closure no matter what happened. It was as if they were on Mars. Within 12 days, one of the original biospherians nearly cut off the tip of her finger in the rice hulling machine. And, of course, one of the 8 has to be a doctor. So he did his best. He sewed it back on. But when she held it up to the visitor's window for the best handman in Pima County to look at, he said, you know, you're in trouble. You might lose that. You've got to come out. So within 12 days, she went to the hospital. She was only out there for 5 hours. They counted or approximated how many lungs full of our air she breathed. And when she went back in, she carried 2 shopping bags with her. And what was in them, nobody knew. Still, it blows the whole thing in our imagination. They're not really on Mars. You know, why not order out for a pizza, for God's sake? And so as this thing successively went on, during the second year, as Michael's saying, it was hard to balance CO2 and O2 levels. And what's great about this is our biosphere is doing the same thing for us and also recycling our water. There, it's accelerated. So that even though it's Arizona, where there are 330 days of sun a year or something, they had a few cloudy days. And when they do, the plants are not producing as much oxygen or absorbing as much CO2. And finally, it was as if they were up at high altitude, getting altitude sickness. And since they'd already broken closure in the second year, they began to bring in oxygen, which, again, to the mind of the public, kind of defeated the purpose. So, in my telling, it's the second closure, and my Terranauts are determined not to make the same mistake. And so Ramsey, in particular, talking to you, says that he wouldn't care if somebody died. There's nothing short of murder and cannibalism that's going to have him open that airlock. And he says of the, he says, reflecting on the character whose fingertip had been injured, he said, "What's a fingertip? Hell, I'd give all 10 fingertips, my toes too. What's a fingertip to Shackleton? What's a fingertip to any explorer or Terranaut?" So I have this wonderful tension presented by the real history. If there were a second closure in real life, and a third, and a 49th, and a 50th, they would have to adhere to this. You can't play with it. And by the way, NASA is still after this. You may know that in August, NASA just concluded a 1-year closure in the Mauna Loa crater, where they had 6 men and women who were allowed to go out, but they had to wear spacesuits in order to simulate what it might be like. So this idea is one that it will never die. Can we create another world that is self-sustaining?
I'm curious. This is hardly the first of your books to be based on historical data. Do you get corrections from participants in the events you've written about telling you you've got it wrong or you got it righter than I could have imagined?
Of course, occasionally. And you know, in the old days when people wrote letters, I don't know if any of you remember that era, people would write to the magazine where the story's published only to correct you, not to say, hey, I love it, and so on. I present the history as it is because I love the history. It fascinates me, and I want to present it to you. But there are no rules. You know, I wrote The Women about Frank Lloyd Wright. If I wanted to, I could have him abducted by aliens, you know? Here's one I haven't thought of for a while. 1993, The Road to Wellville. It's about John Harvey Kellogg, the inventor of the cornflake and his Battle Creek Sanitarium. He famously, with great hubris, said, "It's a matter of nurture. You find the worst kid in Chicago's slums, and you bring him to me, and I will raise him, by the way, with his 22 other children, as my own, and he will be a tremendous success." Well, he was wrong. George, especially in my telling, but I think what I gleaned from the small amount of history about George was that he stood in opposition to this dictatorial patriarch and his regime, you know? So, Alan Parker made a movie of this, The Road to Wellville, got a lot of attention and so on. So when I went back to Battle Creek to address a crowd like this, all the people who really despised me for being a guy from L.A. with an earring who stole their history stayed home. And the people, some of whom had worked for Kellogg, old ladies who had worked for Kellogg, came and they kind of liked me and they essentially said, "Well, Sonny, you know, you got it right," and so on. But as I was signing books, there was one woman who wouldn't look at me, and she was in the back of the crowd, and she was kind of tearful and angry, and finally she said to me, "I can't believe what you said about my father." "Well, who's your father?" "George. George." So this is, you know, a footnote in a history from 1905, but here's the real woman claiming, if it's true, that I had dissed her father. I mean, I didn't even know her father. I'm just making up a character from what happened in real life. And I did apologize to her. And furthermore, a friend had told me that if you coat your body entirely in Vaseline, tar and feathers will not stick. And I missed one patch on the back of my neck. So I'm sure I didn't interview any biospherians. I'm not interested in that. I'm not like Tom Wolfe, who is coming out of a journalistic background and he wants to go and he'll tell you how many spots are on the Dalmatian in the firehouse. I'm not interested in that. I'm interested in taking the real thing and finding where it goes in fiction. I'm a fiction writer. So I'm sure the real biospherians would like to correct me on many, 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 many factors. But that doesn't enter into my worldview. My worldview is that of imagination.
Well, in addition, sometimes the things you're sure must have been made up turn out to have been fact. For instance, here, I assumed that Tom, in having productions both inside the structure and from the master control group outside, they're both doing productions of The Skin of Our Teeth. And if that isn't good enough, The Bald Soprano. Talk about theater of the absurd. And then when that's done, no exit. Turns out that they did, because the guru genius who
John
invented
Allen.
The project loved theater, was himself
an amateur actor. He'd been in La Mancha on Broadway. So I'm inventing a character like him, but I don't know him. This is not a Romano Clay. I'm inventing characters, but I'm taking these wonderful details. Couldn't make this up. So it's science, but it's not science. It's theater, but it's not theater. And so, yes, in the actual biospherians, part of their training was to work together in the Australian outback on a ranch, to work on a research vessel together, to bond as a crew, but also to put on theatrical productions because the creator felt that this was a way of bonding. Again, some of the stuff you couldn't really make up, but it is the real history.
But a question to the aesthetics of writing. Are there some things so unbelievable that even if true, you couldn't include them?
When I wrote Drop City, which published in 2003, it's about the Back to the Earth movement of the 60s, the hippies. I found a wonderful book written in 1963, before we really had the hippies or they were familiar to us. Who are these? What is this strange tribe with long hair and, you know, and the women don't shave their legs and they live, you know, in huts and raise goats? Who are these people? And in the back was a glossary of terms, you know, like far out and all of this. It was wonderful, wonderful, wonderful stuff. But I found that one term in particular had been used historically. And it is not far out. I'm blanking on it now. Does anybody remember? There's a term that we were sure the hippies had used, and yet it was used in 1900. And I wouldn't include it in the book because people would think, well, wait a minute, that violates the timeline of this thing. That just doesn't belong here. So occasionally I will tinker with such things.
I was looking...
Out of sight. Out of sight. I found in Theodore Dreiser's Carrie. And out of sight meant really good. Really good. Just as it did in hippie times. But if I'd included that, imagine those letter writers, Michael.
I reminded my assistant that we used to say, "That's not my bag," not once a day, but many times a day. And you can hardly believe what we once spoke like within living memory.
Well, yeah. I used a similar expression every time my wife and I leave a restaurant or a theater. I say to her, "Oh my God, where's my bag?"
I'm curious. Have you written a sequel yet?
I haven't. I think I'm too curious. I'm always on to the next thing. I'm always trying to find something out. There is so much about our mysterious lives as apes on this planet and the universe and what we learn about it and the technology that is radically transforming every minute of our lives that I haven't yet. With that, there is one exception. I wrote a story called The Marlborough Manchester Musser Award, which was in my big fat stories too, DC Ball stories too. And it's about a very obnoxious writer. I've never written about writers before. He's a very, very obnoxious guy. And I kind of liked how obnoxious he was. So the very new stories that will be in the book coming out next year, The Relive Box and other stories, I've written him into another story called Subtract One Death. And I may even use him again in the way that Updike created Rabbit. But I couldn't imagine writing a sequel to any of my novels at this juncture.
Well, because in this one, there's a character, any reader will be able to say who it is, who couldn't have existed in history, but whose future I'm very interested in. You know who I mean. The first years of her life are going to be spent in sequestered existence under a dome, knowing only four other men and four other women. And I'm curious about her future.
We have to talk in code here because we don't want to give away the surprise of the book, but already I guess we are. If you know, animals tend to mate, you know? And I just wondered about that. And since there are 52-year closures, what will it be like? And by the way, one of the things that is utterly fascinating to me is this is a mix-and-match world that they created. It's whimsical. You would think that with all of the scientists involved in building this world, they would have taken a single biome, let's say the Everglades, and they did take some of that for their swamp. But they just kind of willy-nilly threw in creatures for fun. Michael is most intrigued by the Galago, the bush baby, because I mentioned them all the way back in Africa in water music.
I'm sitting there. I have something of a photographic memory for my reading. And I'm thinking, Galago, agapo. Where have I seen this word? And then I remembered it was in Water Music, Tom's first novel. I haven't seen it since, but it was, what, 30 years ago?
Oh, they're probably extinct by now anyway, Michael. Don't worry about it. So the Biospherians included Galagos. And this is also called the bush baby. It's a very cute, adorable little animal of this size, and it's a prosimian. It leaps through the trees. Why? For fun. For fun. They're creating a world, and they include a creature for fun. The fascinating thing is, what if they had 10 friendly billionaires, and they built 10 of these things a mile apart, and there really was 100 years of closure for each? Each of those biomes would have been an entirely separate world, evolved in ways utterly different from each one, with a different suite of creatures and different events. It really, so they're criticized. It's not science. It's theater. Science works from having a theory and then seeing if it's true or not. This was more theatrical. It was, yeah, let's put a bunch of people in with a bunch of animals and see what happens. And I think, looking back on it, it is valid because we learn things, like, for instance, the weight loss, but also, once the weight loss occurred, all of these eight people who had all lived privileged lives and had the best of food in the richest country in the world had blood that was flooded with DDE and DDT and so on, because when you lose your fat, these chemicals that are stored in the fat are released into the bloodstream. So we are learning tragic things, horrifying things about our larger environment by having an experiment like this.
I might add that those bush babies, of course, they're as cute as koala bears, maybe cuter, and they're on sale in the gift shop outside the structure.
Right.
Because they're trying to raise money, of course. Come up with something still cuter, but I won't tell you what.
And there is this whole element, of course, of the audience being drawn in, the tourists. It's still a tourist site, but in initial phases, these people were famous and everybody wanted to see them. So you would pay your money and you would press your nose to the glass and there they are covered in mud, slopping out the pigs, you know, or whatever they're doing. And the Mission Control ran with this as a production, really.
Thank you, Tom. I'm going to open this up to the audience, yes? There are microphones that will be coming around so that your question can be recorded for the posterity of the event.
Loved Water Music a number of years ago. I found I needed a dictionary to read it because at least one word on every page I didn't know or understand or hadn't seen before. I had Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, but half the words I looked up weren't even in there.
Well, of course, some are invented, but also...
That's what I wanted to ask you.
Novelists, we have a couple of tricks up our sleeves. One is we tell several stories at once, and once you're totally involved in one, we immediately switch to the other. Just to have fun with you. And we use preposterous words in order to club you over the head with them. I would say, though, seriously, that often the odd words come from a subject matter. So that in the inner circle about Dr. Kinsey, who invented sex, of course, I have got all these terms from his researches. In Dr. Kellogg's book, you know, the Road to Wellville, I have unusual terms of that period that fascinate me, and they're kind of funny. In reading them, maybe you look them up, maybe you don't, maybe you just blow right by them, maybe you just like the way they sound. I mean, that's something to be said about words too.
Hi, Mr. Boyle. I first saw you 31 years ago at the Endicott Bookstore in New York City. And I was just wondering, now that we're in this wonderful venue, your talks, I'm sure, are giving in many different forms. What do you think about this thing about, you know, print books are pretty much obsolete. I had a guy I wanted to bring. He goes, well, I can't get that book online for less than $14, so I'm not coming. So I sprung for the money, and I want you to sign it, and this one too, which I lost since you inscribed it. But e-books, do you have any take on, I know you're talking about now genetic engineering. Clearly, your art form is devolving, I think, into a different tactile experience.
Okay,
do you have
well
any
said.
Thoughts?
Yeah, okay, very well said. So first we have to talk about our relationship 31 years ago. I presume that was when my mother still had me on her knee back then. Yeah, I remember that vaguely. I had a lollipop, I guess. I am always inventing things in my basement lab, as you well know. And what we're going for now is the brain implant for all readers. And my voice will talk directly to you in your sleep. And you only have to subscribe for $19.99 a month.
I get asked this question all the time too, as if somehow or other I'm supposed to rise up and bite the questioner's nose off. If you're reading, I'm happy that you're reading. I'm glad you like to read. Who cares what you read on?
I agree, Michael, and I will say this. You know, I spent a lot of time in the Sequoia National Forest. I rent a house up there from an old friend who has a pretty wonderful library of not valuable books, but books that were produced maybe 30 or 40 years ago in big reader's editions, hardcover, leather-bound books with some illustrations in them. So I go up there, and I reread things like Dostoevsky's The Idiot or Crime and Punishment or H.G. Wells. And to have the actual book in that size and format is wonderful. And yet, here I am on tour, you know, dragging two bags of dirty underwear from city to city, and the Kindle comes in pretty handy for that. I don't really like it because I can't page through and can't find things, but it's lightweight. And you can read it in the dark.
They haven't really figured out how to do poetry books yet. Things that really depend upon lineation and the shape of
exactly.
the page, that doesn't
exactly.
work yet.
This is another issue with some of us artists. How does it look on the page, even fiction? I always work in double space so that it will, every page on my computer and previously in the old days, typewriter, will pretty much replicate what the page will be in the book. So it was 500 pages long. That's about what it was. And I love to see how it is set on the page as a kind of picture. By the same token, I always listen to music when working. And I always read aloud to my wife once I've caught up and have enough to read to her after work, because the musicality of the language is very important to me, which is why I have never been a fan of genre literature, which for the most part, I mean, it's hard to generalize, but for the most part, is not giving you rhythm and beauty necessarily. And all of that, aesthetically, is very important to me. And so the Kindle doesn't have it, you know? The Kindle is kind of alien to me, and yet it has its function. You can read in the bar while hammering shots of tequila when the lights are out. This is an important advance.
Again? You mentioned science and nature, but other than those, what sources or publications do you read? Or I guess more broadly, how do you get your information about the world to stay engaged?
I still read a newspaper in the morning. I like the feel of it. I do not watch TV. I have never seen any TV news. I don't have time. It doesn't interest me. I'd rather read something. I listen to NPR, though, and get news in the morning and evening from that. I read widely. And, of course, a lot of my reading is confined to a given subject in the period when I'm trying to write a novel. Of course, people tell me things. Anything anybody tells me tonight, for instance, I will steal and use for my own profit.
Oh, I'm so happy to be able to ask you this. I have one question that I wanted to ask the guy who drove the Mars Rover at JPL and also T.C. Boyle. What are you afraid of? I know what the Mars Rover driver said. I want to know what T.C. Boyle says.
What am I afraid of? Everything. Everything in the world. What are you talking about? How you'd have to have had a lobotomy not to be terrified of every second of life. I mean, we're all going to die. We're all condemned. We're on death row. How can you not be terrified? And, of course, I think a lot of what I'm writing is projecting fear, and a lot of what we love in literature, a thrilling scene, will the character survive? My story, short story, After the Plague, in which everybody is dead except for a couple of people. Well, there's a thrill in that because we're not dead yet, and we can enjoy it. Yes.
I'm a huge fan of Tortilla Curtain. And I've read it and reread it many times.
Oh, okay, yes.
Hi. I'm a huge fan of Tortilla Curtain and have read and reread it many times. And I want to know if there was a real-life Candelario in your life.
If there was what?
A real-life Candelario. Wasn't that
Candido,
his name?
Candido, you mean?
Yeah.
Candido?
No. Yeah. Everyone presumes
that these characters are people I know. The two couples. She's referring to the fact that this is a book about immigration from the South, published in 95 when it was really a hot-button issue. Sadly, it remains still a hot-button issue. And assumes that I am writing from the experience of actual people. No. It's a kind of fable, really, when you think about it. And I've invented types, and then the types, as in this book, take on a life of their own and become fully fleshed, animated characters. I've only twice in my life based a character on somebody I know. In one case, a man who becomes the villain of Budding Prospects. He likes being a villain. He wears T-shirts that say Budding Prospects on it. To this day, he is thrilled. And the other wasn't quite as happy.
Yes, thank you. It sounds like it's unlikely that we're going to be reading a sequel from you, but nonetheless, you've repeated characters in at least a couple of books, Jerpak from Budding Prospects yes. and Friends of the Earth, and I think his daughter appears in The Harder They Come. Is that
correct.
Right?
Yes.
I'm wondering, using your wonderful imagination, if you can extrapolate a bit, what do you think Aorta would be doing these days, or Alex?
So Ben is referring to Budding Prospects, which is set during the punk era in Northern California. It's my second novel, and it's about a pot plantation, an actual story of friends of mine who felt, let's grow so many pounds of pot and we'll all be rich and everything will be great. But, of course, they'd never left their apartment, and nature maybe isn't as cooperative as they might have thought. It was a complete disaster and so hilarious. And some of the characters Ben is referring to are girls in a punk band. What would Aorta be doing now? Well, I suppose she'd be going to the surgeon to have some of those spikes removed from her skin, maybe, it's a good question. But there won't be a sequel to Budding Prospects, although I think there will be a TV show of it. Amazon has bought this to make into a TV series set in its time, which I suppose would be wonderfully ironic since we will soon not only have our first female president, but we will legalize pot in California in just a few days. So thank you very much, folks. You're a marvelous audience. Thank you. And thank you, Michael.
Pleasure.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Nana and Martin J. Wolf, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.